Session number 13265, reel number 16.
Marsden reel 16.
It was extremely difficult to find a fighter aircraft in the sky painted with this scheme, and even when found, it was extremely difficult then to identify it. Nevertheless, the word came round that we had to paint them in a new colour which was be known as sky, and the formula was issued by which we would mix blue, a given code number of blue paint, white and yellow to produce the colour sky, which was a very pale blue with just a hint of a tint of green in it, very slight, not very much at all. Well, of course, the first squadron to get the news on this haired off, belted off to the main stores with its demands for enough paint to paint the aircraft in the squadron. The second squadron to get the news did the same, and the third squadron got in the queue behind. I don't know if our squadron was the third in the queue, because it was apparent that by the time our store bashers had drawn the 5 gallon drums of paint for us, we were going to be a little bit tight. And the riggers started mixing up the paint according to the formula. I forget, I used to know how much it was, but I can't remember. And we started painting the aircraft. Naturally, you start at one end of the line because there's a limited number of mixed drums of paint, like two 5 gallon drums have been used to mix paint in. There's a very limited number of brushes available. So you start at one end, paint that aircraft and pass it down the line until you get to the far end, 10 or 12 aircraft. And of course the paint runs out and you go to mix some more and you start again and quickly you find that you're running out of blue. There's plenty of white, there's plenty of yellow. The result is that you start at one end. At least our aircraft in our flight in 145 squadron, I'm certain it applied to other squadrons. At one end you get the aircraft which comes out pristine sky, the very nice light blue underneath as desired by Air Ministry. By the time you get to the other end, it's no longer the original sky as desired, because you're running short of blue and you're adding in more yellow to make the amount up, and you end up with a distinct duck egg green. So instead of getting 12 aircraft or 24 aircraft all of one colour, you get 24 aircraft divided by 2, say, in a graduated scale of colours, from the original sky, a blue, to a different kind of sky, a duck egg green. So that all the talk about correct colour schemes for aircraft in the Battle of Britain, which you can see in history books and aero modellers books and all this sort of stuff, is highly theoretical if they don't take account of this fact. And so from the time this order came out and we got into doing it, until all the aircraft on squadrons at that time had been replaced by aircraft coming straight from the production lines with the new scheme, then there was no uniformity in the underside colours.
Was this at Tangmere or Westhampton?
This was at Tangmere. And, of course, this applied right through Fighter Command. There were changes in the Rondel scheme at this time, round about some at this time too, but it was it's something I don't remember. The changes in the I think in the width of the yellow outline, or whether you had a yellow outline on the rondels or not, and so on, changes like that were occurring quite often. Anyway, let's now jumping into 1941 at Linton-on-Ouse. During the first winter there, whilst 35 Squadron was being worked up and had become operational, it was decided that aircraft recognition was rather more important than anyone had given any weight to earlier. And so the station's CO decided that there would be an aircraft recognition competition, and anyone could enter. Not only aircrew, anyone on the station. And so, I don't know whether it was in the Naffy or the station cinema or where it was. Probably, I guess, the station cinema. The competition was held one night with all the station, all the aircrew on station there, and all the ground irks, ground crew who wanted to be there, who could get in, present. And I went along because I was rather keen on aircraft recognition at this time. And so I took part. As I recall, we had there were about 100 different pictures flashed upon the screen, either of whole silhouettes or partial silhouettes or partial pictures of aircraft. And I think I got 84% and won the competition, which did tend to upset the aircrew. Because the station CO took rather a poor view. I was by this time, I think, a corporal. Took rather a poor view of a corporal fitter beating up all the aircrew on station in aircraft recognition, because he thought aircrew ought to be good at it. Of course, I'd been living aircraft and carrying aircraft images in my head for years. Whereas a great many of the aircrew types had only recently got involved with aeroplanes at all. The thing that annoyed me was that the first prize was a dollop of cigarettes, and I didn't smoke. So I had to scratch around trading the cigarettes for chocolate rations. I think I'd mentioned that 86 had been landed... belly landed by I said Cheshire, and I was baffled as to why Franklin was mentioned. I was recently reading one of the Halifax books published in this last two or three years, in which it stated that the takeoff during which that aircraft had its starboard undercarriage damaged, or well, I'm sure it was the starboard leg, was taking off in a diamond pattern of four. The odd thing is that I only visualised three. When I run those pictures through my head, I see the aircraft on the starboard wing of a Vic of three, but I'm not denying that there might have been four there, because I think it's quite possible that that watching that aircraft do a kind of fighter takeoff and sag and bounce its undercarriage, the importance of that event might have washed details away. So I would make no claims on that, but I think I have mentioned that it was used afterwards as a kind of laboratory on station for redeveloping the hydraulic system of the re-engineering the hydraulic system of the Halifax. What I didn't mention was that round about this time we had a detachment of four squadron on the station, and that they were using Lysanders for convoy patrols over the Humber and coastal shipping coming down towards the Humber, and that they had Lysanders equipped with 20mm cannon fitted to the undercarriages in the place of the Lysander. Could carry a kind of winglet which was bolted to the spats, the streamlined casings on the main wheels on the undercarriage leg, and that winglet could carry a small bomb load, I think four 20-pounders or something of that order. Well, in the place of those winglets a 20mm Oerlikon with a single 60-round drum was fitted on each of the main legs of the Lysander, and I remember asking about it and being told that when the pilot fired these guns, he had to start firing with the aircraft in a slightly nose-up state because the recoil of the guns was sufficient to tilt the aircraft nose down, which meant, of course, that firing and hitting anything with them would be quite an interesting little exercise. But as our friend Michael Caine says, that's one of the things that not a lot of people know about that. I've never seen a photograph of one of these Lysanders with the guns installed anywhere. And I mentioned too going down to St. Evel after the La Police raid. I don't think I mentioned that whilst we were there I saw Hurricanes taking off to fly to Gibraltar, and that these Hurricanes had fitted a very large bath type long range fuel tank on the underside of the wing. If I were to be asked to give a snap decision, I'd say it was fitted under the starboard wing, quite close to the main leg, quite close in. I don't draw up an image of two tanks. I have this asymmetrical image when I draw it up, but I do remember that it was so big that when the aircraft was taxiing there was only 2 or 3 inches clearance below the trailing rear corner bottom of the tank. They were fairly crude tanks. I would think, to visualise them, they would be of the order of 2 feet wide and approaching 2 feet deep, with a blunted roundish nose and a suitable streamline, more or less streamlined tail on them. I think this was an attempt to fly Hurricanes to Gibraltar, and then on, I think the idea was to fly them on to Malta as a part of a reinforcement system to see if it could be done. There were 2 or 3, I think, took off, but I don't think any of them arrived. And it was quite a while before the RAF caught on to the idea of trying long-range flights by single-seat fighters like that with an escort, a twin-engined escort with a navigator aboard. And I think there was another attempt to fly aircraft from Gibraltar to Malta, again where some were lost because of this. The New Zealanders in 42 caught on to this quite quickly, because their first attempt to fly a squadron of P-40s up to the islands resulted in practically the total loss of the squadron. There were P-40s either in the drink or scattered on beaches all over the place in the relevant area, and so after that they always sent their reinforcement squadrons forward with either a Hudson or a Ventura as navigation escort. Well, that brings us back up to date to where we were. Somewhere around this time, say sometime from August 41 onwards, but within the next 6 months, I'm not at all clear as to exactly when, my aircraft was taken and a radio altimeter prototype was installed in it, and 2 boffins came along with this thing, and we had the job of flying this thing under their instructions for several weeks, at least 6 weeks to my certain memory. and the idea was that we had to fly as near as possible at 60 feet because it was intended that this radio altimeter was intended to be used to enable aircraft to fly at 60 feet for some specific purpose. I wondered about torpedo dropping, because 60 feet was in those days was a fairly normal height from which you dropped torpedoes. But we didn't know. It was highly secret. We weren't supposed to ask questions, and we weren't even encouraged to watch the thing whilst we were in flight. I flew as flight engineer on these flights, and we trundled all over South Yorkshire at 60 feet. The pilots, of course, greatly enjoying it, because low flying with permission, and in fact under instruction, is a highly desirable state of affairs to the average lively pilot. And I can recall hammering at full bore over a train and frightening the driver and stoker to such an extent that the stoker threw lumps of coal at us. Not that it was going to do any good to an aircraft doing about 250 miles an hour. And we also flew over a chap on a tractor and startled him so much that he fell off. And I can remember looking back and seeing the tractor going round in little circles in the middle of the field, and this bod picking himself up and shaking both fists at us in fury. What you have, if you're not aware of it, you have to understand that even a four-engine propeller-driven aircraft approaching either on a takeoff along a runway or approaching at low altitude at any kind of speed can be almost silent until it passes over. Then it passes over with a blam, and of course is apt to shake the unwary out of their socks. And this is part of the fun for the pilot, of course, and the people aboard, who regard it as being quite hilarious if you can shake the hook up. So we had 6 weeks of this. Unfortunately, the radio altimeter was highly erratic. I can recall being allowed to watch it and seeing hedges and trees and even cattle and sheep indicating with a flick of the needle as we flew over them. But apparently it was unreliable and inconsistent, and the boffins were struggling with it, and so it was, after 6 or 7 weeks, it was taken out of the aeroplane, and that was the last I heard of it. It did, however, it does, however, to me, seem to have fitted in with the planning and preparations which eventually cropped up with the dambusters. Although it may be quite too far ahead of it for it to have been directly connected, but it was certainly, there was somebody in Air Ministry who was looking quite a long way ahead as to the way things ought to be. Now, in late August or September of 41, the conversion flight of 35 Squadron became 28 conversion flight and a separate entity. And did I mention the point at this time about being changed over, handing in our tools and making a sit-down strike?
No.
Ah, well, when we became a separate entity, we had to hand in our toolkits, our toolboxes and gear, to 35 Squadron. We had to hand in all our bedding and everything else, because they were on charge to us as members of 35 Squadron, so it was almost like being posted. We had to get clearance from the squadron and hand all this gear in, and then go along to main stores and sign a lot of it out again, because obviously we had to have bedding, we had to sleep, but it had to be signed out to us now to the charge of people on 28 conversion flight. However, our toolboxes were signed back in to 35 Squadron stores themselves, and we were not issued with any from 28 conversion flight stores, because 28 conversion flight stores had been set up too quickly for any stores to have come into existence. So we still had to operate the flight. We still had to get our hours of conversion flying in and turn converted pilots out, but we had no tools. And it's quite difficult to service Halifaxes without simple things like GS screwdrivers and 3/16 quarter Whitworth spanners and BA spanners and things of that order. The fact that most of us had our own screwdrivers and spanners and things in our pockets is irrelevant. I always had pockets which were so cluttered up with spanners and screwdrivers that I had a fair old job in keeping my pockets intact. It was my pockets always had more holes than pocket, and quite often the lining of the tunic as well went through, so that for instance I couldn't carry money safely in any way because of this business. I always had to carry a purse because the purse was too big to go through the holes usually. That's a habit I never got out of. So, whilst with an effort, it was possible to take cowlings off and put them back on and so on, it was with a considerable effort, and it made all our work that much longer. For instance, after we'd finished flying and we had to get jobs done on the aircraft, instead of, say, taking an hour and a half or 2 hours and being able to pack up and get back to the billets by 10 o'clock at night or 11 o'clock, I mean, we were working considerably longer because we simply hadn't got the tools. And eventually I decided that it was enough. This must have been after a week or 10 days of struggling with this situation. And I suggested that we all simply sit down in the hangar and say, and wait for someone to come along and say, why aren't you working? And we simply said, well, of course we can't. Because if you haven't got official toolkits, you can't do official work and sign the Form 700 to say you've done it. You are quite fireproof, you see, in this situation. You can be quite neddy and stroppy and be absolutely fireproof, because you can't be accused of mutinying or anything of this order, because you've got everything on your side. So we did that. We sat down in the hangar and the flight sergeant came out and in dulcet tones wanted to know why we were all sitting there on our fat backsides and not out on the flight line servicing aircraft, and acting as spokesman I gave him all this bilge, you see. Just well, he knew it, of course. But somebody in the new unit hadn't done his job, or somebody in station main stores hadn't done their job, which was why we were without this equipment. And what we were doing was forcing their hand. So I can't remember whether Willie Tate was our CO at this time or not, on rest. Who it was, but anyway, of course the word fairly rapidly got to the CO on this, and within a matter of 24 hours I think we were being issued with toolkits, and this problem was sorted out, which was a great relief to everybody concerned. Just one of those odd things that happens when a service expands faster than its capabilities. And shortly after this, we moved to Leconfield. Oh, by the way,
this is 28 conversion flight.
Yes, I should mention that whilst this business went on, in order to keep going, I'd advised our chaps that if they were on circuits and bumps on any other station, as was not unusual, if they saw a toolbox lying about with no obvious owner, it might be a good idea to spirit it aboard an aircraft. Well, of course, you do that a few times and the word gets round that toolboxes are being stolen. this was one of the ways we'd kept the unit going, you see, in the meantime. Well, the word did get back, and Chiefy had found out that one or two toolboxes had been mysteriously acquired, and we'd been recommended to return them, you see. That was what brought the whole thing to a head. Having returned these illicit toolboxes, we were unable to cope. Very illegal and rotten, but that was the way the service was, of course. The term was liberating in those days. So we moved to Leconfield, and Leconfield was not an entirely happy station, because the station CO was not the kind of man you would wish to have for your CO, generally speaking. And the other thing about Leconfield was that it was miles from anywhere, and anywhere was Hull, and Hull's miles from anywhere anyway, as you very well know. It's not the kind of station that anybody who wants to get home for 48-hour pass wants to be on, you know, because Hull is slightly off mainstream, isn't it? 60 miles sideways from anywhere, especially in those days. And we got on with conversion flying. The interesting thing was that the main runway in use was only 1,700 yards, which meant that for takeoffs you had to get it right pretty well first time, and for landings you also had to get it right first time, but it did encourage a good deal of practice on overshoots, and people got very good at it, because the prevailing wind being southwesterly, somebody in his wisdom had built across the end, the westerly end of the runway, in their wisdom, somebody had built three or four army Nissen huts and a lot of barbed wire on 6-foot poles and so on, which sort of wasn't an encouraging thing to have at the end of the runway in case you didn't get off or overshot on landing. There was nowhere to run to except these Nissen huts. And Nissen huts and advancing aeroplanes are not a good combination. So we all tended to regard that end of the runway with some apprehension, especially later on when we began to get ice on the runway. And it was about this time that I found that I'd clicked. I was still flying as flight engineer on this sort of thing, and I clicked for a couple of pupils who couldn't get the hang of arranging the throttles for takeoff to give power to counteract torque, so that the aircraft didn't swing immediately the throttles were opened up. With a Halifax, when you open the throttles, you need full bore to be able to get the tail up fairly smartly so that she can roll quite quickly. And on a short runway like 1,700 yards, you need to get the tail up quickly so that the aircraft is taxiing in the clean state. In other words, shall I say, normal to the airstream, as distinct from tail down with a lot of drag. You need to get the tail up quite quickly in order to get speed up for takeoff comfortably. And on the Halley, to get the tail up, it was